All right. Hello and welcome, everybody. We are here to talk about the 7 success practices for bringing your coaching gifts to the world. This is Jessica Stewart, and I am here with the luminous Nona Jordan. Say hello.
Hello, everyone. Thank you, Jessica.
And the miraculous and fantastic Jill Farmer.
All righty. I like that introduction. Hi, everybody.
And today what we want to do is we want to talk about these 7 practices that were actually originally developed by Abigail Stidley, whom all of you will know as your LCT coordinator. See, I knew I'd stumble someplace. But what we really wanted to do is walk you through these ideas because as you're really thinking about getting your practice out into the world, there's really some core, well, practices, clearly, because that's what this class is about, that are going to help you be successful doing that. You know, everybody likes to have a plan. They like to have, you know, whether it's on the back of a napkin or whether it's on a mind map, which we'll talk about in class, or whether it's in just, you know, good old Google Doc or good old Microsoft Word or none of the above. Hopefully not just in your head, guys. You know, one of the things you'll learn in class is you'll actually want to write it down. The key is that if you focus on these success practices, these are the foundation that are going to help you build a really good plan. So many people start by just creating the roadmap or the blueprint or the plan, not really taking time to think about what it means to actually build a successful practice. So we're going to talk about those things today. And the funny thing is the very first practice, and you'll actually see there's a handout that has all 7 listed. What we're going to do today is there's going to be, we're going to talk about each of the practices, but really what Nona, Jill, and I are going to do is we're going to share our own personal stories, experiences, and anecdotes, and we're going to expand on what's there just to give you some illustration and some color to how we've brought these things to life in our practices. So the very first one, talking about success practices, the very first one is to decide on what your own current definition of success is. And the reason we talk about that way is that so often success is colored by our social conditioning, by our cultural conditioning, by our family. You know, my own personal definition of success was very much influenced by my father and my sister because my mom's definition of success was totally different from all of the above. But what that meant for me is that I felt very imprisoned by their definition of success because what success felt like for me, what it looked like for me, was completely different than them, from theirs. And so when I got older, I started recognizing that success is something that's very, very personal. It's a very intimate experience. And I do this for everything. I do it for my business. I do it for each of my programs. I do it for any teleclasses, retreats, anything that I offer or put out into the world. I recognize that, you know, I need to really define success for each of those. One of the things that's really important is that success really is, it's qualitative. It's about a quality of life and not quantitative. And the reason we talk about it that way is because quantitative is, in many ways, the very condition that's gotten us to this stuck place. Quantitative is very much this idea of, well, I need to make X number of dollars. I need to do this, you know, I need to have 12 clients. And it's not that you can't put that on your plan, but you want to start with a quality. What does it feel like? What do you want success to afford you in your life? And so ultimately, that's what we mean by creating your own definition of success. Jill or Nona, what do you guys think? You know, how has this worked in your own lives and your own coaching practices around success?
Well, this is Jill, and, you know, just circling back around to remind people that the resource, the call that Susan Hyatt and Beverly Barnes and I did back for the Finding Your Ideal Client class of First Life, mm-hmm. Then Business, mm-hmm. that, in case you've forgotten, that call really is a lot about deciding your current definition of success. So if it felt a little nebulous or kind of far off back when you were taking that class, now might be a good time to sort of revisit that as another resource as well. And you know, one of my favorite bullet points in this is maintaining the beginner's mind, which is, you know, just recognizing that it's, for me, that one of my superpowers that I've finally learned to recognize is curiosity. So when I go into starting a new program or a new class or a new way of telling the story about my about my individual coaching practice, I look at it like, okay, I'm curious to see whether this way of communicating connects with the people who need this form of healing. And when I come at it with that sort of, to me, that's, you know, one of the ways of connecting to the beginner's mind, whatever happens is, again, just data. It's not, you know, a clear signal that I am not good at this. It's just data. And so that, to me, beginner's mind is a really, you know, powerful process, or a powerful way to start in the process of really defining what you want it to look like. And I have to say, Nona really helped me revamp my whole definition and my way of being around abundance, because I had such a linear view of money and bank accounts as being the only way that decided whether I was, you know, in lack mind or abundance mind. And by the way, I never did seem to make it into abundance mind, no matter how much money was in the account, because I could always come up with a lack story. So I don't know if you want to talk about that at all, Nona, but I know that was really huge for me in my practice, and in helping me, fueling bravery and grit for me was making that shift.
Well, and I was going to actually ask you, Nona, so that's a beautiful segue. When you think about definition of success and it being a qualitative and not quantitative, especially when you think about abundance, mm-hmm. when you think about, especially because you work with so many people around money, what does that, how would you speak to that for folks that are saying, yeah, but I need to define it by a dollar amount or a number?
Right. Well, I mean, the first thing I would say is that there may actually be a dollar amount that people do need to meet if they're supporting a family. And so there is that. Mm-hmm. I mean, so I don't want to discount that piece. However, if you can step beyond that, I think that one of the things is that when people think abundance, when they think about the word abundance, they're not actually thinking about abundance. They're thinking about something else. There's something else underneath that they're actually going for, right? Sometimes it's safety. Mm. Sometimes it's contribution. Sometimes it's joy. You know, there are things that underlie it. So I think if you can call it what it is, that's what you're really aiming for. It's like, okay, I want to feel safe. So that's why that's what abundance really feels like to me, is this feeling of safe. So it's kind of what you were talking about, Jessica, right, is that going for the qualitative, not the quantitative. It's the same thing. So understanding what abundance really means to you. Mm-hmm. And I think anytime, just speaking to this whole thing, what I often say to people and what I watch out for myself is anytime I'm saying should or need to, or anytime there's a line in the sand that causes me to feel grippy, like I must have this outcome, you know. Anytime I'm in that space, it's like an opportunity to get curious and to back up and be like, okay, wait, what is it that I'm really, what need am I trying to meet here? What am I really wanting to accomplish? What's the bigger picture? Because I think people can get hyper focused on the numbers, right? That quantitative piece, and they fail to take into account the bigger picture. Like, I want to have more time for my family. I want to do work that feels amazing, you know, when I'm doing it. And what's that worth?
Right.
You know, what is that worth to you? So maybe you're not going to hit the number straight out of the gate, but look at all this other vast abundance and all of these resources that are available to you right here and right now if you can sort of step back and look at the bigger picture of what success is for you.
I love that. So, Jill, I'm curious if you're willing to share, when you worked with Nona to get clarity around abundance, could you share one of the qualities that you came up with around abundance, like something
well,
that
I think
you
the biggest
valued?
Thing,
yeah, sorry.
The biggest thing that comes to mind is just Nona would help me turn back to how everything is actually really okay exactly where I am.
Yeah.
So that was the space that I launched ideas and made decisions about where to invest money in for building a practice and where maybe I was going to hold some money back in reserve, you know, versus spending it. Because my MO when I got in that lack mind of, oh, it's not going to be okay, was then to go, you know, to just kind of wantonly spend money on things that I was hoping were going to fix me and make me well enough, you know, good enough to,
exactly.
to be good enough, and or to then or to just hold into this kind of really restrictive space. Conversely, I kind of would pendulum swing before between the two of this really restrictive, like closed off, scared, unwilling to take any risks or to stretch myself or to leap at all because I was too scared that I wasn't going to make any money. And neither one of those spaces were a good place for me to
create.
Expand my practice,
right.
Both from an experience perspective and learning and growing and gaining more knowledge and or from a financial perspective. So really teaching me to take a second to look where I was and notice where abundance already existed helped me then to get in the mindset where I was more likely to make decisions that would create more abundance, a flow of money coming in, as well as ideas and allow me opportunities to learn, stretch, and grow.
Love it. It actually builds in really, really nicely with the next success practice, which is building belief in yourself. So taking that time to build belief in yourself, like you were taking the time to really redefine what abundance looked like for you, that you know, taking you out of that gripping, painful area of that really was contractive versus expansive in your coaching practice. To me, that really is about or related to this idea of building belief in yourself, because when you can trust yourself to create the abundance, to define the success, to support yourself in whatever you're doing, you can actually be much more successful. It's like the two feed each other. It's like a koan. Where it's like you can be successful if you believe, and you can believe if you're successful, or whatever. I don't know. It's terrible, but you get the point.
Yeah.
So that particular success practice is, I mean, the key about it is really belief in yourself and your capabilities and your abilities is from actually doing. So it's actually about taking action, setting reasonable goals. So much like when you are defining your success, the next step is, well, how can we begin really seeing if I can do this? And it's not sitting down and creating this grand plan with a million items on it. It is from doing, but it's really from being very kind to yourself, so being very specific about how much time you have each day to work on your coaching practice, how much time you have to devote to your family, right? It's all going back to those definitions of success. I don't even know if that makes any sense. It makes sense in my head, but it's actually done from that evidence of doing. The other thing that's really interesting and the one that kind of stands out to me on building belief in yourself is trying the kindness diet. This is something that Abigail started talking about a while ago. People would often call her Pollyanna because she had such a positive worldview on things. Oh, it's too nice. But really what she was doing was practicing kindness, being really, really kind to herself and really for us to be very kind to ourselves in the days we don't believe in ourselves, reaching out, getting support, much like you, you, Jill, reached out to Nona to get support when you weren't being kind to yourself around building your coaching practice. That, to me, is one of the things that is really critical to building belief in yourself. One thing I also wanted to just mention here is a lot of times when, you know, cadets, coaches in training are at this point where they're getting ready to launch their practice, or they have been launching their practice and their training is about to end, they go into very deep compare and despair. I'm not where I should be. So-and-so is so much more successful than I am. And ultimately, compare and despair is you're trying to compare your insides to somebody else's outsides. And it's really about noticing how you're trying to compare your piece of the pie to somebody else's piece of the pie. Pam Flynn used to talk about that. And you don't know what's going on with the rest of their pie, so you can't compare those two things. Mine is peach, by the way, because I'm a real
mine
peach.
Mine is key lime.
Oh, of course. How about you, Jill? What kind of pie are you?
Cherry.
See, you can't compare peach, cherry, and key lime because they're so unique. Those are each of our definitions of success. If we can be that kind of pie, we will be okay. But so in terms of building belief in yourself, what are some of the things that you, and I'll start with you, Nona, this time, what's something that's really helped you build, specifically, deliberately build belief in yourself and your abilities to build a coaching practice?
You know, one of the important things that happened for me at some point at the beginning of my journey, because, and I think this is pretty common for coaches in training, cadets, people who are just starting their practices to be like, well, I've only been coaching for X number of days. I've only been doing this for so long, or I just got trained and I don't really know what I'm doing. And I think that there is this tendency to sort of like cut ourselves off from before training. But the fact is that at some point I realized that I came to Martha Beck coach training with, you know, 40 years of experience, 40 years of education, 40 years of deep personal work that I had done before I knew what coaching was. And when I realized that I could bring all of that with me, that all of that came with me, and that I could utilize all of that, and that the coach tools were actually just kind of the way in, the way to share what I already knew. Like, I knew more than I thought I did. And I guess that if I could convey anything to the people who are listening to this, is I would say, you have so much experience, such vast knowledge, and don't just focus on, well, I've only coached two people. It's like, that might be true. And the what's behind that is years and years of living your life.
I love that. Well, we actually talk a little bit more about that in the Practice Everything, I think is the other one, and we'll talk about it a little bit more.
Oh, no,
but
did I get ahead of myself?
No, it's actually perfect, because what you're doing is you're really showing how these all work together, and I also think you're demonstrating how we so often discredit our own experience and we put other people on pedestals, not just our teachers and mentors and leaders like Martha or even one of us. I don't know. I mean, you know, we're instructors. We're awesome. So why not? No. But really, when you put someone else on a pedestal, you are completely discounting and discrediting your own experience and the gifts that you have. Just because, I don't know, just because Susan, who's not on the call, but, you know, Susan Hyatt has been coaching, has been building her coaching practice for, I don't know, 8 years, and someone on this call may have only had two clients, it doesn't mean that Susan is automatically better or elevated. It just means she's different. She has a different experience. She started someplace. She got there by building belief in herself. And so I think that's a really excellent tie-in for that you know, kicking over the pedestal, Nona. So thank you.
Well, you are welcome.
And I love it when you quick starts get ahead of yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and I totally agree with everything that Nona said. And just really to add that, I mean, the biggest tool for me to build belief in myself in my own practice as I was building it was to just coach my face off. And I know we keep saying that to you over and over again, but it's just such important data to be willing to try coaching with people that maybe you didn't have it in your, you know, in your mind's eye, that mm-hmm. you knew you wanted to coach, and notice where your essential self lines up with them or doesn't, and use that all again as data. But the more coaching I did in whatever form I could do it, trying group stuff, trying individual stuff, the more I gained that evidence that doing that I could believe in myself, because I could feel myself slipping into that rhythm. And maybe sometimes in an hour-long coaching session, I was in that rhythm for 10 minutes of it, and the rest of the time I was floundering a little bit. And that for sure happened to me, I guarantee you. But sometimes magic of 10 minutes of really connected essential self to essential self conversation is enough to have somebody else create that aha or that kind of awareness of what they needed to see. And then maybe the next time it was 15 or 20 minutes and it went from there. So this just, I think, goes back to that broken record of coaching your face off is a really good way to build to build belief in yourself and to develop. You kick over the pedestals and you tune into your own the stargazer wisdom. The more you do it, the more you quit looking outside of yourself for the way to do it, and the more you begin to listen to the signals of how you uniquely operate as a coach with your unique original medicine, to use that term we introduced in the attracting your ideal client.
Right on. I love that. It's not failure, it's feedback. That's really, in many ways, the message here is coaching your face off. You've got to go in with this curiosity and recognize that even if it's 10 minutes and the rest is floundering, that's not 50 minutes of failure. It's just 50 minutes of feedback. And you know, unless it was a 90-minute call, in which case it was, you know, 80 minutes. But that's the idea, is that it's that 50 minutes wasn't a failure. It was the feedback. And it actually leads in. Jill, I feel like we've planned this. I don't know. We actually didn't, everybody. We just wanted to have a conversation. So you're so good at the segue.
Hey, can I say something really quick?
Oh, my
about
gosh.
This?
Yes.
I'm sorry. I'm going to totally
messing up my segue.
Up your segue. I'm going to do it. But it just came to me when Jill was talking, and this whole idea of building belief in yourself, and people are like, well, I need to believe in myself before I can go out and do something. You know, there's like this either or kind of thing, and I was thinking, gosh, there's the and. You know, I'm not quite sure, and I can still go do it. I just wanted to say that, you know. I really just wanted to say, add the and. It doesn't have to be either or.
Yes, that is one of my favorite tools. It's actually in Joy Diet, unifying the false dichotomy. We get into the either or, and it's really living in the and, bringing the and into mm-hmm. practice here. So building your belief in yourself, living in the and is a very important part of that. So thank you for interrupting and messing up my segue. It's totally worth it. It wasn't failure. It was just feedback that I needed to check back in with you. See? So one of the things you were talking about too, Jill, was that 10 minutes of success. Really, that falls under the third success practice, which is to do stuff and gather data. I love Abigail. She's good at turning a phrase. Do stuff and gather data. And one of the things that's what part of doing stuff and gathering data is really just do something. Get out there. Don't focus on perfection. Be willing to experiment. All of these things fall in. But what that 10 minutes is really looking for the bright spots. And I love, love, love that you brought it up, because that's actually one of the single most powerful tools that a new coach can begin to learn. in order to go out and do stuff and gather data is to look for the bright stuff, the bright spots. And that's where are things working? How can you recreate that? So what did you do during those 10 minutes that was brilliant? This is where recording your client sessions, getting permission from them, of course, to do so, but recording them and then listening to yourself so that you can find out exactly what you did in those 10 minutes so that you can recreate it for the rest of the session. This is actually an idea that the Heath brothers introduced, and we included a link to a YouTube. But honestly, to do stuff and gather data, I really feel like the bright spots is such a huge part of that, and celebrating those successes rather than just focusing on, well, 50 minutes of, quote, feedback kind of hurts. What do you guys think about this one in particular? Jill, how about for you?
Well, this is, you know, most of my body of work is around time and mm-hmm. overwhelm and all those and the way that we kind of sometimes paralyze ourselves with as Nona articulated, waiting until we get it together or feel, waiting until we do believe in ourselves before we actually start doing it. And so particularly for those of us that tend to have perfectionist tendencies, which was me, I had a lot of, okay, when I get this perfect, then I'm going to launch. Then I'm going to, you know, when I figure out exactly what I'm supposed to, you know, my exact narrowest, tiniest niches, then I'll go out and speak to groups or try workshops. And when I let that go and was willing to just, you know, throw a workshop where exactly one person who I, by the way, had just said come for free came.
Awesome. Where I did hey, they that. Came. Bright
yeah.
spot.
And it was. It was a bright spot. And then some really magical things happened, and they gave me some great feedback. And then somewhere in those practice clients that I had, there was a cardiologist who was so into the stuff that I was teaching about time. You know, I was generally mm-hmm. working with people who were stuck up to that point, and particularly she and I just hit this sweet spot of my own hero's journey, which was around never having enough time for anything. What I had learned and had the strategies and tools that had moved me through those old belief systems of not enough time really mm-hmm. resonated with her. She asked me to give a talk at the med school where she taught and practiced medicine at the hospital, and I walked in for that, you know, free lunchtime speech that I was giving, and it was standing room only with
wow.
men, women. And
that's
so
awesome.
Then I was like, oh, there's my feedback. I quit counting, but there were at least a half dozen much emptier venues. And every one of those gave me something that was just about as valuable as the finally getting the full house. It just was different. And the other thing that she taught me is I use that line, perfect is the enemy of done a lot. And she mm-hmm. says in cardiology, they even say better is the enemy of good, because in cardiac cath procedures, a lot of perfectionist doctors would get 80% clearance of a blood vessel and during the procedure, and they would go in and say, okay, let's get that last 20% cleared out. And then invariably, in a pretty high percentage of them, they were blowing up the blood vessels when they were trying to get
gosh.
That last 20%.
Oh, my gosh.
So that was a reminder to me that often I can be done and move on at 80%. And, man, do I free my energy and my time up to explore, rest, learn, and just let stuff take root when I let go of that last 20%.
Oh, my God. That is like the best example I've ever heard of how perfect is the enemy of done, because better is, what do you say, better than
better
perfect?
Can be the enemy of good. Good.
Yeah, better can be the enemy of good. Well, and I want to share before I go on to you, Nona, is well, what I wanted to say is, as a Square 3 coach, a lot of what I spend my time doing is in this realm of do stuff and gather data with my clients. It's really, this is where I end up having to do a lot of just hand-holding and reminding, like, guys, sometimes you just gotta go do something. And having a conference or a, not a conference, a teleclass or a workshop that only has one person in it, that's still, there's still something to be gleaned, like you were saying. One of the things that we had to do for Master Coach training is we had to give a teleclass, and I had to adopt, in Master Coach training, I had to adopt the idea of being playful and curious, because I was just a constant sort of nervous mess around messing up, because it was really hard for me not to want it to be perfect. I wanted to be the best. Not just good, but better, but best. I don't even know what that looks like. I want the 100%. And I had to be willing to just put it out there and get the feedback. I did a workshop or a teleclass for my assignment, and it was definitely uncomfortable for me. It definitely didn't go the way I wanted to, but it was also one of the best absolute learning experiences for me. And the only thing that really prompted me to do it is because it was an assignment from somebody outside of myself. You know, it was like someone had to, quote, make me do it in order for me to take that risk. You don't have to do it for an assignment. The risk is it's not risky. The market's not going to remember that you had a crappy teleclass and only one person showed up. People might remember that I did a quote-unquote crappy teleclass. Most people tell me they didn't think it was crappy. And I also met some really great people as a result of doing it, because that was really what I was meant to learn out of it. So I just wanted to assure people, like, that is how it gets done. Even we have one people on the call, or we do less than perfect. So, Nona, sorry.
Oh, my gosh. That's totally okay. I love that. Well, I think this really goes back to what Jill was saying about curiosity and play. I was living in Italy when I started my coaching practice, and so I was like, okay, well, I'm just going to throw some pasta at the wall and see what sticks. So that was kind of the metaphor that I used to keep it playful, which was, I'm not naturally that person. Jessica knows that. She's my business coach. So, you know, I need constant reminders to keep it light. But as a result of kind of taking that tack, kind of what Jill was talking about, like just kind of following the breadcrumbs, following the hot tracks, I think at some point I was ranting at Jessica about, I was doing just business coaching, and then I was ranting at Jessica about money and worth, and she was like, you should do a teleclass, which is like the last thing I wanted to do was a teleclass on money. And I'm like, well, I think I will. And she's like, okay, well, go do it. And I did it, and it scared the shit out of me. I think Jessica had to, I think she had to pull me off of the ceiling.
Yeah, I like the pasta that you dried there. You're like, ah!
Yeah. And it was one of the most successful, it was the most successful thing I had ever done in my practice, and ended up completely changing the direction of my practice from what I had thought it was going to be. And it was scary, but it was also, I was willing to step out and do it and look at the feedback. So really, that curiosity and that willingness to go to the place that scares you, because there's usually gold there.
Well, I'm going to segue into number five. I'm going to just put a hold on number four. I'm going to go to number five, which is be willing to feel discomfort, because I think that that is exactly what you're talking about. That is such a perfect – you're like always one step ahead of me, girl. No, it's perfect. So something that you said about be willing to feel discomfort was really powerful. You really – So you did. You told someone that you were nervous, which was me. Mm-hmm. So we helped work together to build some belief in your capabilities of running this teleclass. You then actually ran it, but what you did was that you were ultimately willing to feel uncomfortable. And there's something that you talk about in terms of being willing to feel discomfort that I really love, and I was hoping you could share it. It's actually that quote that we came up with.
Yes.
So could you explain that to everybody, that this idea of having to experience the full spectrum of success?
Yeah, absolutely, because I think this is really important too. Because I think, okay, I'll start from the beginning. So I've been thinking a lot about how we really live on a spectrum, like from the inkiest, blackest, darkest, you know, corners of our psyche or whatever, all the way to the brightest, lightest, most divine, lit up, illuminated parts of ourselves. And we live somewhere on that spectrum. And I was having a chat with somebody, and I was thinking about that whole idea of go big and be all you can be, and how that always implies the light end of the spectrum. And it just like slapped me in the face one day. I was like, oh my gosh, but you have to be willing to experience the equal and opposite darkness that comes along with that, the self-doubt, the judgment, the fear, the haters, the criticism, you know, the all of that stuff, you know, that comes along for the ride that we try so desperately to get away from and stay away from. We absolutely have got to turn our face toward that with a willingness to feel it, experience it, and let it move through to keep growing on the light scale. It's like you don't just get the light scale. It's the full spectrum. It's the full catastrophe, as Jon Kabat-Zinn would say. And we tend to be, you know, very much like, well, it has to be good or it's bad. But it tends to come in equal measure. You know, it's like my fear was huge in running that first teleclass, and the light that it brought to people and the benefit and the expansion it brought to me was equal to the fear I felt.
I love that, because it ultimately, I think what, when we were talking about that teleclass, what we discovered was this idea that you were uncomfortable because it's really where you needed to grow next.
Yes, absolutely.
It's where you were meant to kind of move. And we didn't even know it was that you were meant to be a money coach. Well, I knew that, but you weren't ready to be a money coach. But it was more that it was like, because you were so incredibly resistant to it,
right,
it was absolutely the best thing for you to do. And it ultimately was. I mean, it turned out, you know, to be tremendously successful.
Yeah.
So I love this idea that, and we talk about it too in terms of contrast.
Mm-hmm.
We have to experience the contrast in order to experience the light.
Mm-hmm.
So how about for you, Jill? You've never been uncomfortable in your entire career, have you?
Oh, I think I'm going to tell an uncomfortable story that will might transition from this to back to, I think, question number four quite well. And I,
perfect,
after doing that kind of success, the time where there was a standing room only hospital talk, I got asked then, I had like a little round of all of a sudden doctors' groups started asking me to come do stuff. And so there was a surgeons' group that asked me to come do a workshop. And I, oh man, surgeons, important, I better know my stuff, and they better really let me know that I'm good or I'm not okay. And so, you know, foreshadowing, big attachment to the outcome, huge attachment to them telling me that they loved it and I was okay. And basically, I did this kind of dinnertime workshop program, and not quite, but came close to getting heckled off the stage by these very left brain people just questioning every single tenet that or tool that I was sharing about moving out of the fight or flight stance in when it came to time stuff. And afterwards, when I came home and cried and pounded a pillow and let myself feel my feelings of disappointment and unworthiness and all the different stuff that came up, and came down to what I was able to distill is that I had made it mean that unless that by anybody questioning or asking me questions about the stuff that I had come to believe was really effective, that I must either be wrong or not, my stuff might not be good. And when I was able to recognize, no, my intention is to allow people to explore a potentially different mindset about this stuff, and it so happens that really intense surgeons sometimes explore that by questioning and being argumentative.
Echoing.
And when I was able to stay in future groups when that happened in a really kind of clear, anchored space and hang on to that curiosity to why they felt so threatened by trying something different and expecting different results, I got this rich dialogue that then ended up being some of the most, I think, the most interesting anecdotes that are in my book were around these exchanges and some of the heckling that took place. And it got me clear on ways to answer other people's doubts that maybe they didn't have the chutzpah to stand up and ask out loud. And so even if I'm in a group now or doing a workshop, if somebody doesn't outwardly question some of these things, I'll often bring up the things that happen in that, you know, sort of nightmare bomb of a workshop. And so you might be thinking this so that we can move through it. And I'm much more lightly attached to them walking away, you know, saying, this was great and amazing. And then, of course, coincidentally, not most of the time, people seem to have some impact by the content that I'm sharing, the less attached I am to it.
I love it because you did, first of all, tie it back to number four, which is to hold the vision lightly. But I also love that you illustrated that you were willing to experiment and feel awkward because you were holding the vision, like you moving forward, not necessarily at that one, but at future ones, you were willing to hold the vision lightly. So it sounds like you were the reason it bombed, and tell me where I'm wrong, is that you got very attached to form, what it had to look like, and you know, what success had to look like in terms of that talk being successful.
Bingo.
Instead of staying in the flow of feeling and really being fully present of how you were feeling. So if you were reading anxiety, if you were noticing some level of stress in your body, fear, if you could just stay in the flow of that feeling and move it back towards comfort, ease versus the fear, that's what ultimately turns it out, you know, helps that kind of situation turn out perfectly.
No doubt. That's beautifully articulated.
Well, thank you. So the other thing, too, that you illustrated and is where your attention goes, you go. And so if you're fixating on this, oh, my God, this is going terribly, and you said this essentially in the future, you know, in future talks, you kept your attention to where you wanted to go. It's like, okay, we're going down crap. River here. let's turn our attention elsewhere, and we're going to focus on something a little bit more positive. And so you're able to turn a conversation around that way, or turn a program around, or a coaching session around. It's only whenever we get attached to that outcome that ultimately we reap what we sow, which is crap. So how has that been true for you, Nona? Do you have any examples or anything to add in general here?
With holding the vision lightly?
Yes.
Yeah, because I think this is a really, I think this goes back to kind of what Jill was talking about earlier with the abundance piece and staying present and noticing. And it's a real dance that I think we do. We set a vision and we hold a vision, but if we're out there in the future with the vision and we're holding on to it so tightly, it tends to engender fear and lack thinking more than it engenders empowered action when we are out there like grasping onto what we want at the end of the day. So, you know, I always invite people, absolutely, you hold a vision and you have this beautiful feeling state and you know what it feels like, but the real work is to come back to this moment, to the present moment, into your body, and what action can I take right now in this moment that is going to, you know, bring me that same feeling, that same quality that I hope to feel out in the future, and then letting go of expectation. Because what I have found is that when I can do that dance, because I still get in that place where I'm like, I must have this outcome, you know, and it just shuts everything down, you know. Nothing works when I get in that place. But when I can come back to the present moment, it's like, okay, I'm okay. Here I am. And what can I do? How can I take action or not take action?
Oh, yeah.
Right?
That's
right. Going to bring me into that feeling state right here, right now, and open me up to whatever is coming.
Well, and that's because when we have that, when we strangle our visions, essentially,
<love that.
laughs> what we're doing is we're not being playful or curious.
Yes.
I don't know. I'm sorry. Serial killer stranglers, they're not very playful. Well, they might be curious, but not in the kind of way we want to think about.
Yeah.
So don't get you. The playful curiosity is meant to be light. It's meant to be, I don't know. It's not meant to feel heavy in your body. And any time we're holding on to something so tightly, that's what sinks us.
Right. Yeah, I always think to myself, you know, this or something better, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's like,
me too.
You know, that's my vision. That's awesome. And it, this or something better. You know,
this
and that goes back
or
to
some
feel,
goat cheese.
Feedback, not failure, right?
Totally.
Like, okay. Yeah.
Did you hear my comment, this or goat cheese?
Or goat cheese, that's right. And I'd like mine with some crackers. Thank you.
Okay,
much.
Good. That's okay. Better. It's even better. I wanted to mention one final thing here, which is that so much of what you're talking about, too, whenever we're holding that vision and we're strangling it, I like how I brought in serial killers. I don't know how I managed to do that. But is ultimately, it's because we get so fixated on how. We can't believe it. It's never going to happen because we don't know how. And Mike Dooley talks a lot about this in his books. He's a law of attraction guy, for those of you who don't know him. He also does the Tut Adventurers Club, Notes from the Universe. And he talks about really what kills a dream faster than anything or kills a vision faster than anything is the cursed hows. How's it going to happen? How's this going to happen? So he's always telling you, go back to the feeling. Go back to where, you know, the vision. Hold it lightly, this or something better. And anytime you ask how, which is that strangling, that's what cuts off the flow of abundance faster than anything. Mm. Beautiful. So we have two more, and one I just want to bring. Sorry, Jill, was there anything else you wanted to share on that? I apologize.
Nope.
Okay, cool. I'm trying to be a good facilitator, everybody. So practice everything is success practice number 6, and we actually talked a little bit about it in the Build Belief in Yourself. Nona was mentioning how that was her path for her really beginning to understand that she could do this thing, whatever this thing was, be a money coach, be a business coach, be a yogini at one point. Well, you still kind of are.
I am.
But ultimately, it's the path to building belief in herself was from this idea of recognizing that she had been practicing this thing called life for well over 10,000 hours, and ultimately remembering that it's cumulative, that, you know, and Nona, you said this actually when we were first pulling together this outline, is that we've all been perfecting a pattern our whole lives, both positively and negatively. And it speaks again to the spectrum, the shadow and the light. It speaks to Jill's experience as well with the failure of the well, it wasn't a failure, the feedback of the talk with the doctors was recognizing that experience, the shadow of that experience, is just another bit of practice. Practicing getting up and speaking in front of somebody, which, Jill, you've been doing, I mean, it was effectively your entire career up to that point.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me where I'm wrong.
No, you're right.
And so that, you know, in many ways, recognizing, it's like, look, you used to be on the news, so if you can get up and do it in front of millions of people, then you can bounce back from this one experience, because this is where you have been practicing. This is your mastery, is getting up and being responsive to conversation. So practice everything. I love that. So for you, Jill, how else has this really been practice everything? How does this play into your successful coaching practice today?
When I decided to launch a coaching practice, I created this boundary or this box subconsciously, and mm-hmm. I think maybe it was Nona, who's my business coach, who helped me, or a couple of the people recognizing that I it, actually
circle
you
of
did
life
that,
here.
Jessica, you did in Master Coach training. I remember it now, because I had this story that was behind me, and I left that career as a, you know, TV journalist for good reason, which, you know, I did. But what I'd done was then created a wall that said anything that looked anything related to TV stuff, I had to cut myself off from and start over again. And you know, you were the one who said, hey, some people kind of find that part of you interesting.
Well, I did.
Why don't you use that? Why don't you use that as part of your story and your hero's journey and why you lived this life of frenzy and overwhelm and how you tried quitting the job to fix it and discovered that the issue is really in your head, not in the outside circumstances. People might find that interesting. And so when I was able to embrace the mastery of things that I had mastered from before, like, you know, video and things that were that came naturally to me but that I was trying to not have in my coaching practice because that was from my old life, when I was able to look and say, okay, what have I mastered already and how can I take the essence of that or that skill and fold it into this new practice in a way that makes it even more uniquely mine. I was, again, looking for an outside template of how somebody else's coaching practice was supposed to look, and if it didn't include a life about a story in, you know, TV news or, you know, some of the other skills that I had, I cut myself off from that. So that was the one thing. And the other, to the other point in this from my own experiences, I got freaked out, again, about money, and I had an opportunity to do some kind of freelance jobs that were related to my old job, some TV work, and I thought, oh, I can't do that anymore because that will mean that I've not been successful as a coach. And I got some coaching around that to say, well, how about if that revenue stream is showing up for a reason to fund your continued pursuit of this passion? And it's not going backwards at all. It's just revenue showing up with something that you can do with your eyes closed in order to continue. It's an and, not an or not a going backwards. So I did take some freelance jobs even after I'd opened my practice, and I continue to occasionally do it now because it's easy money, and it just feels like I unkink my hose a little bit to let that flow versus looking at it as a backwards moment. And I'm not saying that's for anybody else to necessarily do. I just had created, again, a false paradigm in my head about what success looked like and what I should or shouldn't do in relation to taking on work like that.
Well, it's ultimately, too, finding the bright spots of it, which is exactly what you did. You recognize, well, you know, what parts of this aren't horrible and make me want to cry. Can I do those in pursuit of something bigger? And using your mastery to help create a segue to a new level of mastery. I think that that's actually something I talk a lot about with my clients who, you know, who have done very similar kinds of things or were resistant to doing similar kinds of things. One thing I wanted to do is offer an example here as well on kind of this idea of persistence, tenacity, and being willing to walk away before I am only sharing it because I'm going to forget otherwise. But something you said kind of reminded me of it is this idea of video and, you know, doing things that you didn't want to do and then being resistant to it. So when I started out, I found out I had a real knack for doing video. And so I, just because I'd been such very technical, the huge part of my career had been working for large technology companies, so I was incredibly familiar with technology, so much more so than most of the coaches that I know. Actually, you guys are much the exceptions on this call because you're all very technical, which is cool. But I found that my mastery was a really good way for me to kind of play. And so I started creating a little bit of a side hustle in my coaching practice where I would make videos for other people. And I tried different models. I tried getting different clients. I was very persistent and very tenacious in trying to grow that part of my business. And then I just recognized that that is simply not what I wanted to do. I liked creating art. I liked telling a story, and I liked telling it my way. I'm very particular, apparently. I'm very snobby. And so I recognized it was time for me to walk away from that part of my business. I no longer wanted to make videos for my clients, or find video clients that I wanted to make videos for. I don't mind necessarily doing it for my existing business clients. But it's just an example of how something that I had practiced and something that I had had a mastery at helped segue me into another part of my coaching practice that ultimately I walked away from. That's how you do it. You don't have to make a big deal about it. You don't have to freak out about it. It's just like, okay, that wasn't fun anymore. New line of work, and so I moved on. And your story actually really reminded me of that, Jill, so thank you. So how about any feedback or thoughts here for you, Nona?
Well, I love Jill's story because I did the same thing, and I think a lot of coaches do that. That whole, like, cutting off the past, like, I will never do that again.
I will never play with money again.
I will never play with money again, and business, screw the man. You know, I mean, the whole shoot and match, right? I mean, just boom. I thought I was going to be a health coach when I first started. Like, I was convinced I was going to be a health coach. Yeah.
And you're not?
Nope, I'm not. Financial health, maybe.
Exactly.
We could say that. But, yeah, and the thing I love about what you said, too, is, you know, when I first started my practice, and I've had some people be kind of shocked about this, and I'm like, oh, right, you don't know me. You didn't know me then. I started my practice building websites because that was something I had built a technical proficiency in, and I was so uncomfortable asking people for money for coaching. I was like, I need to actually provide, I need to get used to asking for money, mm-hmm. you know, for doing something for somebody. And so I started my practice that way and then slowly started layering in coaching to the website building work, business coaching, mm-hmm. and then finally let go of the the site building and just stick with the business coaching. So, yeah, knowing when to let go of something, right?
Yeah, and I'd almost say that I might revise this success practice or have a parenthetical here too, which is to me it's like knowing when to say when, and so really being able to it's like practice everything until you don't want to do it anymore.
Right.
And
right.
then move on. It's kind of like learn when to cut and run. We'll see. Maybe for future recordings, maybe we'll revise it. But I think ultimately this one very much captures this idea that your experience, all of it kind of builds up to this idea that, you know, practice your boundaries. Practice knowing when to say when. Practice walking away. All of those things, that's practicing every part of it. Because that's what's going to help you build a really healthy coaching practice is when you're able to do each of those things.
Mm-hmm.
And be very conscientious or conscious of it as well. Whew, that's a good one, guys.
That is a good one.
So we have one final success practice, and I'm very proud of myself that I've said success practice correctly. I'll leave it to the imaginations of the listeners what I had been saying, or accidentally, I swear. And the final one is actually one of the hardest things for people to kind of, because of the social conditioning, because of our cultural conditioning around what marketing and, quote, selling is, this is one of the hardest, which is ultimately to connect to your soul or your stargazer or your higher self or your intuition and learn how to market your practice from there. This is exactly how I work with every single one of my coaching clients. I actually talk about this, and Nona can speak to this from experience, is we talk about sort of the difference between good marketing practice or good marketing principles and marketing tactics. Every time one of my clients has connected in with his or her intuitive knowing, stargazer, self, soul, whatever it is, soul wisdom, and marketed from that place with just a little bit of an eye or an awareness around successful marketing tactics or principles in some cases, which is like sometimes you want to give yourself, I don't know, 6 weeks to market a telecourse. But actually, wasn't it even the money one that you did, Nona, your first one? You didn't even do 6 weeks. You did like a month or something.
It was three calls.
Days.
And then it was three calls, and then I ended up adding a bonus call in the end.
Well, But in many ways, like, and I actually think this is true of a lot of quick starts, sometimes I've seen people just throw a call out there in, you know, a few days or a week or a month, mm-hmm. not because that's necessarily what I would advise is the best thing to do as a marketing person, but I also recognize that there is a deeper knowing for my client or a deeper lesson that he or she is meant to learn. And the only way to learn that lesson is to do stuff and gather data. For, say, Nona putting that money class out there in a shorter amount of time than I might have recommended, I don't even remember exactly, you were still hugely successful because you knew. You knew it was time, you felt the demands, like you tapped into your inner knowing and you were like, boom, this is going to happen. And boy, did it happen.
Yeah.
That's because you trusted the most important instrument, which is you, which is that intuition that you have.
Mm-hmm.
Those, when you market from that place, it's all success because there is no failure in that place. It's all just feedback. It's all just this idea that I'm going to play with this. I'm going to be playful curiosity. I'm going to see what happens when I put it out there, because your intuition, your soul, your higher self, whatever, I'm just going to call it your soul because this could get to be very long. Your soul knows that there is a lesson for you to learn here. The key question I have is, are you paying attention? Mm-hmm. Are you taking the time to do your work and listen to the message? For you guys, both, because you both have very successful coaching practices, and I know this because you have defined success for yourself and you are hopefully doing that work. So for you, Jill, how has this, whenever you really market from a place of soul wisdom or intuition, how does that work for you? Or when you ignore it, how does that work for you?
Well, for the most the most effective example I can give of that is when I launched my book, I got all up in a bunch ahead of time about what I was supposed to do and the marketing plan and hiring a publicist and all the things that I was supposed to do to market the book. And when I got quiet and kind of just sat back down and said, okay, what's my original medicine? And I'm good at sharing in, you know, a public forum what I'm passionate about. And so I just felt really good about calling old friends and contacts and people that I knew all over the country who were radio and TV and newspaper reporters, and told them why I had written this book and why I was passionate about it and what I thought mm-hmm. That I could help their viewers take away, and it just kind of flowed in this unbelievably organic but amazing way that I was able to tell the story. And it doesn't mean a lot of times just because you do a TV interview that translates to, you know, thousands of book sales by any means, but I knew that it really that was a very my intuition told me that that would be a really good way for me to spread the message and the content about the book. Because more than I was even interested in selling books, because you don't make that much money off each sale, was sort of spreading the message of the content of the book. And in a lot of ways, that kind of helped that spread like wildfire in a way I never could have predicted. So that's the best example I can think of.
That's an amazing example, because that's ultimately the perfect example of what I know I talk about over and over and over and over and over again until people want to punch me in the face. Please don't. Is that marketing is not selling. It's really just telling people what you love, why you love it, and then telling them over and over and over again in lots of different ways. I obviously love telling people about what marketing isn't, and so I tell them that over and over and over again in lots of different ways. But that's what you did, is you wanted, you know, your heart was pure. You went from this place, there was no grasping energy, which is really important here. Soul energy doesn't grasp, it doesn't need. That's that fear-based lizard energy is the one that's like, I've got to do it. Scarcity mentality versus abundance mentality. Mm-hmm. Soul is always in abundance. So when you go and ask your friends and your colleagues and people you know to share in this experience with you, I wrote this book and I want to share it with you, you did it from this place of love, and there was no agenda.
Right.
And ultimately that's the most successful practice, is because you'd already moved on and started doing other stuff. You weren't sitting there waiting for your first review / invitation / you know, whatever most people are expecting whenever they ask for help to roll in. Just that simple sort of conceding to another person, inviting them in and saying, hey, I'm really in love with this. Would you come join me? Yet no attachment if you don't want to. I'm totally okay if you don't. That is so hugely successful. Only every single time.
Only every single time, that's right. I think where people get kind of messed up around that is they make it mean something if people don't take them up on it. You know what I mean?
Yep.
I like to use, so when we lived in Italy, we threw a lot of parties, and we had a guy who worked for us, Mike, who used to serve at our parties and do all the cooking. And I liken it to being at a party, like you've got a bunch of people at a party, you're hosting a party, and if I stood back in the kitchen with a plate full of food, like, ooh, gosh, I don't want to bother people. I think I'll just stand back here in the kitchen and wait for somebody to come and find me. So, no. You have to go out and you're like, hey, do you want some of this delicious food? And some people say yes, and some people say no. And they don't get annoyed because you're just sharing what you got.
Well, right? In a way that's authentic and caring and is focused on that loving, abundant place. I mean, can you imagine if a server took it personally every time someone at a party refused a canapé?
Right.
You don't want my bacon wrap scallop? What's wrong with you?
Oh, my God. Do you hate me?
Oh, is it bad? Is it bad? Does it not taste good? Are you sure?
No.
Should I take it back? Should I quit? I'm quitting.
Exactly. So, I mean, and I'm not trying to poke fun, because I've certainly been in those situations, too, where it has felt,
I am.
You know, right? I mean,
I'm delighted,
you know,
in it.
The fact is, you know, that it's all about just stepping out and sharing it with love. That's right. It's like, this is what I got. And, you know, if you're in that abundant mindset, if you feel love, if you feel that real alignment with what you're offering, it becomes really easy to talk about it in a way that it people respond to.
Well, and what I love, too, is this idea. I really like this server mentality, too, or not mentality, or analogy. Because
it's a really good analogy, I know.
It's beautiful because it shows, too, because think about the server. They don't come out once and then disappear because you refused it the first time.
Right.
They give you another chance. And they're not forcing it. They're not, like, opening your mouth and shoving it down your throat. I mean, and honestly, that's kind of how sometimes marketing can feel, which is, I think, why so many people get really turned off by it, is they will feel like somebody's trying to force something on them. Mm-hmm. But much like Jill was doing when she was sharing her work, her body of work, her book, it's just this, you know, it's sort of the find different ways to serve it up. Find different ways to take a different pass. Oh, you didn't want the bacon wrap scallop? Good news. I also made bruschetta. I don't know how to say it. You lived in Italy. How is it?
Bruschetta,
see? So we give them a variety of ways to experience the abundance that we've created. Our talents come in lots of different forms, and so we're going to keep passing the plate and coming around and you know, creating delicious things that people are going to want to try. And it sometimes there's going to be that one person who is in a really crappy mood and who's like, how dare you try it? Annoying vegetarians like myself. Who's like, how dare you try and serve me bacon with scallops? That's just because I'm having a bad day. It's not personal. It's not because you're doing bacon with scallops. That's where you just have to recognize that you might just be serving something that people don't want, and you don't have to sit there and convince them to want it because there's a whole other party of people who want to try it. This is the best analogy ever, Nona. Thank you.
You are so welcome.
So any final thoughts from you, Jill, in terms of, you know, connecting to your soul wisdom and marketing your practice from there? Anything that sparked when we came up with this analogy?
No, other than to, I think what you touched on it, and I think it's really important, is to, it's okay to ask in this analogy to find out from the party guests who you like to party with. Like, you don't want to invite people over who you can't stand to be with. So if you have connected and played with sometimes you get the data and the feedback when you think you throw a party and you discover, hey, I really don't like hanging with this party of people. Good
yep.
to know. And then when you find them, it's okay to ask them, what do you guys like to eat, right? Because, if you have a party of vegans, you're probably not going to, you know, want to do a whole hog roast or like we
don't.
Tend to do
Please
sometimes
don't.
In the Midwest. And so, and then you can get really excited about creating, you know, delicious vegan things. By the same token, if you're in the land of meat, and you all of a sudden try to give people, you know, tofu-laced everything, they may not be so interested. And so it's okay to have that conversation. And again, not to take it personally and not to let every single guest try to create a new menu, but just to know who your party people are and then to converse with them so that you can, you know, enjoy your time together.
Meat. So, well, and two things to add on to that, because this is such a good analogy. Thank you, Nana. And I love how you expanded on it too, Jill, is it's okay to ask people why they didn't like whatever you passed them. It's okay to get the feedback. I mean, don't force it. Don't be like, ugh. It's like, oh, I'm sorry, is this not what you were looking for? And sometimes you can do that in just a very simple way. I actually had someone, I didn't sign up for something that a friend of mine was running a class that I thought looked amazing. And I told her, I was like, oh my God, this looks so amazing. But then I didn't sign up. And she wrote back and she's like, absolutely no pressure. You can totally ignore this email. I was just curious. You seemed pretty excited about it, but didn't sign up. Was it the copy? Was there something? And I was like, oh, it's just, it's at times that I wouldn't be able to attend anything live. She didn't make it mean anything. She wasn't like all wrapped up and worried about it. Wasn't attached to me giving the feedback, but just was curious because I had been really excited about it. It's okay for you to ask for feedback because remember, it's not failure, it's feedback. Sometimes you have to proactively ask for it. And you can also ask them to help you. You can ask them to help you design the menu, like Jill was saying. So having that conversation is a very powerful way to do even better marketing. Not just sitting passively back and saying, well, that party was a bust. I'm going to get out of catering. Best analogy ever.
Now I'm hungry.
I know. I'm actually really hungry. All right. So the final thing that I want to leave you guys with is that you'll notice that all of these success practices, they all work together. They all build on each other. When you are struggling with marketing your coaching practice, go back to the very simple idea of being willing to feel discomfort. Go out and do stuff and gather some data. You know, it's just feedback. It's not failure. All of these continue to work with each other. Maybe the definition of success that you have been operating under is colored by some sort of limiting beliefs, and there's an opportunity for you to go back and look at those qualitative and quantitative success definition that you've created, for you to go back and just say, gosh, is some of this not really in alignment with what I'm wanting? Maybe your life has changed and your definition of success has changed. Ultimately, it's just these all work together for you to go ahead and build a coaching practice that's successful because there's no attachment to the outcome. You're practicing, you're persisting, you're connecting to that soul wisdom, and you're going back and noticing and gathering feedback. Notice it's a cycle that just keeps going. Any final thoughts and feedbacks from you, Nona?
You know, I was telling my daughter a story last night about when I gave birth to her. Now we're going to go from vegan food to birthing.
Okay.
And we were talking about riding a bike because my daughter's 9 and she doesn't know how to ride a bike. And we mm-hmm. were practicing and she was pretty frustrated because she's 9 and she's like, I should have learned this 5 years ago. And she was very upset. And I, after she stopped weeping uncontrollably, I told her a story about when she was born, and I pushed Clara for 5 hours. She was stuck in a weird position, and I had her at home, and there was a midwife standing there, and I was like, I can't do it. It's too hard. It's too much. I don't know what's going on. I'm scared. And she picked up my face, And she looked at me, and she looked me right in the eye, and she said, "This is not the hardest thing you will ever do for your daughter." Yes. And that got me through the last 2 hours of pushing. And what I said to my daughter last night after telling her that story, I said, "I know you can do hard things. I believe in you. I know that there are going to be rough spots, and I also know that you can do hard things." And
wow.
And that's what I would like to leave here for the cadets, is that I know with all that I know about all the people who come into this program is that you can do hard things and light up the night sky with your brilliance.
Jill, do you want to follow that?
I'm just going to follow it with two simple sentences. And one is, there's a reason that you're here. You didn't just happen to fall into this for no reason whatsoever. And even though sometimes it's not exactly crystal clear how it's going to unfold and exactly what it's going to look like, trust that you've been called to learn what you're learning and put it out into the world in your own unique way for something that's much bigger than sometimes our little old-fear brain can imagine. And trust in that light. And I can't wait to see how you guys do all light up that sky.
And on that, I will not even try and follow up anything clever. So be peace, be love, and we will talk to you again soon. Thanks, everybody.